This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Who could have predicted that the price of oil would lose half its value in less than a year's time, and that we would fill up at the gas pump with a gasoline that's less than $2 a gallon? A year ago, there were lots of predictions about the future of oil, many of them full of caution, still with hopeful aspirations of eventual American energy independence. But now we are living in a different world where OPEC is on the ropes and America isn't too worried about oil price shocks. How did we get here, and what does this mean for the future of the Eagle Ford Shale development? We want to hear your thoughts about the future of oil. Also, we want to hear if you are changing your energy habits, or if you are now using a lot more gasoline and becoming more not conserving as much as you used to. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at tprsource. We're joined this half hour by Michael Levy. He is the David M. Rubenstein Scholar, Senior Fellow for Energy and Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also the Director at the Council on Foreign Relations Program on Energy Security and Climate Change. He's the author of four books, but one of them is Power Surge, Energy Opportunity and the Battle for America's Future. So, Michael, welcome back to The Source.
Great to be on again.
Yeah, we had you on about a year ago, and it's interesting going through your book and seeing what your predictions were, and some of them were pretty good. I have to say, I mean, your book came out April 30th, 2013, looking at the future of oil and America's energy future, and not exactly right, but who could have predicted this, right?
Well, I think about the world in terms of scenarios. Energy is extraordinarily unpredictable. Who predicted the boom in oil and gas production that we're having right now? And so that counsels some level of humility. So when I looked out of the world, when I was writing that book a couple years ago, I asked not what will happen, but what could happen. And there were a series of scenarios. There was one where global demand was robust and geopolitical disruptions were high. And then even with strong U.S. oil and gas productions, prices remained $100 a barrel or over. But there was another scenario where global oil production was weak and U.S. growth was strong. And if you combine that with what we knew about how OPEC members actually behave in reality, that pointed toward at least a period of rapidly falling oil prices, followed by a much more uncertain future.
Right. Also, you were hinting at that at the time that with the expansion in American oil production, that the price of oil should have been cheaper than it was at the time, but since that wasn't actually happening, there must be other forces at play. But eventually, it seems like that free market forces eventually wore down the cartels or expectations of long-term high oil prices.
So if you looked at mainstream projections for oil production and oil prices, even a few years ago, what they all expected was that Saudi Arabia and other OPEC countries would gradually expand their production over time in order to accommodate rising global demand at roughly stable prices. And as U.S. production came on, those countries could get away with expanding more slowly or just sort of standing still in their production. Prices still stayed high. The problem for these countries is that with global demand relatively weak and U.S. supply much stronger than they expected, they didn't have the option of just not expanding as fast. They would have had to cut back on their production in order to keep prices high. And politically, it's a lot more difficult to say, I'm going to shrink my production, shrink my exports, than it is just to say, well, I'm not going to expand as quickly as I might otherwise would have. So you almost get a tipping point. It's what some people would call a non-linear phenomenon, that you have a shift to a different sort of regime when instead of having a growing pie to divide among the big oil producers, you have a shrinking pie.
Right. And also, we look at Saudi Arabia as the big player in OPEC and what they do. And in 2008, when we had a similar surge of supply, they pulled oil off the market and they paid the price. No one else pulled oil off the market. They increased their production and they profited from the increase in prices because for the tightening supply. And Saudi Arabia lost consumers. And so I think they learned a lesson from that.
The 2008 experience is interesting because the first thing you see is that even as prices fall from the mid-140s down through $70, $60 a barrel, no one does much to try and stop the slide. So I found it striking that when oil prices this year fell through $70 or $60 a barrel, anyone was surprised that there wasn't a big cut. There wasn't one last time, so it wouldn't have been particularly normal to see one this time. What's striking is that if you look at 2008, even as prices fall further to around $50 a barrel, countries do start to cut, particularly Saudi Arabia, to try and halt the slide, but they fail. And only when prices get to around $40 or $30 a barrel do a bunch of them get together, cut their production steeply, and help stabilize prices. So what's the lesson that you as a Saudi leader might take from that? Well, one lesson is you ought not try to stop a price slide if you think there's a good chance you're going to fail, because that wipes out a lot of the influence that you have in the world. And it wouldn't shock me if Saudi decision makers this time around said, it might be nice to try and stop the slide in prices, but we think there are pretty good odds that we would not succeed. And we'd rather everyone still think that we have that option rather than pulling the trigger and showing that we have no bullets in that chamber.
But it seems that the Saudi Arabia is also thinking that they have plenty of oil, they have plenty of cash reserves, and they are able to produce a lot of oil for a lot less than shale development or many other parts of the world. So they can keep on pumping, and hopefully they might be thinking that they could outpace everyone else.
I suspect that's where they are now. I don't think that's how they got into this situation. I suspect they're as surprised as pretty much everyone else about how this has developed. When I talk to people who seem to have some sense of their thinking, a lot of them will say that the Saudis figured that once prices fell to $90 or $80, shale production would fall off steeply and the market would quickly come back into balance. So along with market watchers in the United States, I suspect a lot of Saudi policymakers are just as surprised and grappling, like everyone else is, to figure out exactly what the decisions by all these players in the market will mean for the course of prices in the next months and year or two.
And the other player is Russia, the second biggest oil producer in the world, and they can't afford to pull back. They've got to pump out as much as they can, right?
Well, it's tricky for Russia. Everyone would like to pump out as much as they can. I suspect that if it were technically possible, Russia could cut a couple million barrels a day off their production and more than make that up on the bump in the price of oil. But there are technical reasons why it's extraordinarily difficult for Russia to make that kind of cutback, particularly during the winter. But on top of that, I suspect Russia would not want to send the signal to others that they're going to try and take care of this problem all by themselves.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation. We're talking about the future of oil and America's energy independence. Have we achieved it, or is that still possible? What does that mean, and what is this happening for the Eagle Ford Shale development? We've got some callers in the queue. We'll get to them when we come back from this break. If you got a question or a comment, we want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980. I want to hear if people are changing their energy habits, if they've stopped conserving because now gas is so cheap. 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The price of oil is still below $50 a barrel. Now that energy is so cheap, the United States has got to change its energy strategies. And we're talking about that with Michael Levy. He is the author of Power Surge. And he talks about the future of energy, how oil and gas production has declined and spiked over the decades. And we're just in another part of that cycle. And what's coming around the corner, to anyone's guess. If you got a question or a comment, we want to hear from you, particularly if you changed your energy using habits because oil is now so cheap. The number is 210-614-8980. Let's get Samir on the line. Samir, welcome to The Source.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think I just kind of have a couple of comments. First, I own a food truck here locally in town, so the lower gas prices are definitely helping us out. So I think from a consumer standpoint, it definitely helps the pocketbook. Obviously, there are some potential job losses that they're looking at this year in the U.S. oil industry. But long term, I don't see any downside because, as far as I know, and of course you guys can correct my numbers, I think U.S. only produces about a third of the oil we consume. And if we want 100% energy independence from OPEC or Venezuela or these other countries, then renewable energy, I mean, obviously we're going to be investing in that. I mean, Texas is the leader in solar, wind energy. But I just don't see how U.S. Oil production will not just keep increasing over the decades to meet if the goal is 100% energy independence.
All right.
I just kind of want to take my comments on that.
All right. Thank you so much for that call. And so let's find out what Michael has to say about the energy independence in America. So that means different things to different people. So what do you think about that?
The United States is tied into global oil markets. And we're seeing right now that decisions in the Middle East about oil production, weak consumption in China and in Europe are affecting us. So that's certainly not independence. But I think your caller is on to something important when he talks about the net benefit to the United States. We now produce about half the oil that we consume in this country, but we are still a big net importer. And while in places like Texas, the balance may turn out differently for the country overall, it still looks like we benefit from falling oil prices. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. The benefit to consumers, the benefit to some businesses like Samir's, is going to almost certainly outweigh the hit to oil producers. Again, in places like Texas, in North Dakota, that is going to be felt differently, and it's important to look at that place by place.
Well, there are certain ways of trying to define what energy independence means for America. Some people try to call it North American energy independence so they could fold in Mexico and Canada, Canadian imports. But also they're looking at, well, if we could just get the price of oil low enough for folks that it doesn't eat up their household budgets, that we're able to spend more on consumer items, and that would be a form of energy independence.
Well, I think it's a good thing if we can have oil prices be lower. And it's important to remember that what's happened with prices is not just about the supply story. One of the things that motivated me to write The Power Surge was noticing that we simultaneously had this big boost in oil production and a substantial decline in oil consumption, adding to multiple millions of barrels a day. And both of those put the same kind of pressure on global prices. If we want to have prices not rebound to previous highs, or at least close to them, if we want to hold prices down over the long haul, we'll need not only this strong production, but to keep moving forward on curbing our consumption, improving our efficiency. That will cut our imports, but it will also reduce pressure on the global market and help people with their pocketbooks at home.
All right, back to the phone lines. And if you want to join our conversation, we invite you. The number is 210-614-8980. Where do you see the price of oil going and America's energy independence? Robert has called in. Robert, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
Doing good.
I'm kind of a fledgling. I'm not fully done with school, but I'm trying to go into the geology field of oil and gas production, and I'm actually trying to switch into renewable energies. Because even though we're trying, we say we're trying to bring down our oil consumption, it's on exponential growth. And every time we hit the doubling point, we require more oil for the next set period than all the oil we've ever consumed in the history of oil combined. And so I think that is what paints a dark picture for oil and gas in the long run. So.
All right, Robert, I understand where you're coming from. I remember I was a geology major at UT Austin at the time of the big oil boom, and then the slack hit, the bust hit, and the joke was, what do you call a geology major, a petroleum land management major? It's, hey, waiter. That was the answer to that one. So is this but this part of the cycle, Michael?
Well, look, there is a price cycle, and I don't expect to see rapidly growing rig counts over the next year. I don't expect to see even flat rig counts. But in this case, because tight oil production requires continued drilling to be sustained, if you believe that prices will remain low because of strong U.S. production, you have to believe that there will be continued drilling in the United States at a fairly high level, continued exploration, continued innovation in order to improve rig productivity. So in that sense, I hate to use the phrase this time might be different, because that's always dangerous. But in this case, this time might be somewhat different because of the particular nature of this development. Your caller also reinforces something else that's very important. Whatever happens in the United States, we have growing global demand, not just for oil, but for all forms of energy. And that puts a big burden on conservation, on efficiency, on developing a whole host of energy sources, particularly as we try to meet that demand in an environmentally responsible way.
So is OPEC a dinosaur now? They came to rise in 1960, trying to stabilize oil prices globally. And how are now are things this out of their hands because of the development of shale technology?
OPEC hasn't been particularly effective at stabilizing oil prices for a long time. If you look over the last decade or even 15 years, it's hard to find occasions where OPEC collectively was able to stabilize oil prices. So if OPEC is dead in that sense, it's not shale that killed it. What is more difficult to put a finger on is the influence that OPEC countries have over the long haul. I think there's still a widespread belief that if Saudi Arabia felt like investing the money to produce 50% more oil or twice as much oil, they could do that. And that would have a radical impact on global markets. It would take time. It would require investment, not just discretion in the short run. But there's that piece of the equation, that long-run investment restraint among OPEC countries that I think is very difficult to discern and difficult to say with confidence that somehow shale is going to kill that as well.
A famous wildcatter, T. Boone Pickens, said that when we deal with OPEC, we are paying for both sides of the war, meaning that the money that goes to OPEC eventually ends up in the hands of some of our enemies.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And it's not just OPEC that we're talking about there. Look, we have friends within OPEC. Let's be frank about that. And we have adversaries both inside and outside of OPEC that are big oil exporters. The fall in oil prices has put a lot of pressure on Russia. That could be converted into gains in trying to roll back their action in Ukraine, though the indicators don't look particularly promising there. Lower oil prices are making it tougher for Iran while we're engaged in a standoff over Iran's nuclear program. So that one is important to keep on top of, too. But there are others that are trickier. Mexico has difficulties when you have falling oil prices. Its government budget is funded roughly one-third by falling oil prices. You don't want the Mexican government to have to cut back on security, on social services, on things that could drive crime and migration. And so it's not entirely a rosy geopolitical picture when oil prices fall precipitously.
Right, but there have been allegations about these oil democracies. And when you have a nation that is able to receive so much of their general revenue, not from a tax base, but from an industry like oil, then these governments are not as responsive to the needs of their people. And so they're able to govern without the consent of the population. And you end up with, governments that we've seen over the years.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that. The big question is, if oil prices do fall, does it mean that these countries are suddenly or even over time going to become much better for their people? There are plenty of resource-poor countries, look across Africa, that don't have oil, they don't have those riches, and that hasn't made them paragons of innovation and technology and capital accumulation and healthy economies. It's made them even worse off than a lot of these Middle Eastern petrostates. The one thing I think we can say is that if you have rapid change, you will have leaders asking, how do I position myself for the future? And that's an opportunity to at least try and help them pick and follow through on that constructive path that takes advantage of lower prices rather than just ending up with nothing.
So when oil was expensive and our leaders were talking about energy independence for national security, part of the plan was developing alternative energy forms. And so is that now longer viable?
Look, it will be challenging, particularly for biofuels producers and maybe for electric vehicle makers who are competing directly with oil, less of a direct impact and really not much even of an indirect one on renewables developers, wind, solar. But the lesson of history is that particularly when oil prices are low, it's important to make sure we push ahead with alternative options so that they're there when we need them. In the mid-1980s, oil prices crashed. Governments laid off the steps they'd taken in the 1970s to insulate us against higher energy prices. They laid off a push forward on research for alternative technologies. They laid off fuel economy standards. And then when prices spiked...
They removed the solar panels from the White House.
That probably didn't have a huge impact on national energy consumption, but it adds in.
Symbolic.
It does something. When the 2000s came, a lot of people regretted that decision had been made. In the 2000s, you had to play catch-up. You had to pass energy policy acts in 2005 and 2007 that are finally biting on oil consumption in the last couple of years. But people sure wish that that had been done 10 years earlier. Right, so when prices are low, that's when it's important to prepare for the future.
Right. So did we learn that lesson? Are we going to stray from this plan for alternative energy development in America and eventually getting off the oil addiction and coming up with alternative energy, renewable energy that America can be sustained on?
I think we'll find out. I have been struck that there hasn't been much noise in Washington in opposition to the fuel economy standards that have been put in place by the Bush and Obama administrations as prices have fallen. We're up for a review of those fuel economy standards in the next few years. There's a legally mandated review. And I think that will be an important crux, an important decision point where we ought to say, let's keep on going ahead with this, but where automakers will feel some pressure, where some of them will come and say, we can't sell these fuel-efficient cars anymore with oil prices like this, and we'll have to find a way forward.
And consumer demand, you see consumers changing their habits.
I think we see a bit of this. The data is noisy, and we have very little of it. We saw a pickup in SUV sales for 1 month.
Pickup sales also.
Yeah, I think you've got to wait a few months to really see where the trend ultimately lies. We'll also see what happens with people's driving habits. I have some colleagues who are economists who've estimated maybe a 10% pickup in vehicle miles traveled, and that would be very large. But that sort of thing can matter as much as some of these fuel economy developments.
All right, Michael Levy, he is a senior fellow for energy and the environment at the Council on Foreign Relations, the director of the Council Foreign Relations Program on Energy Security and Climate Change. He's also the author of the book Power Surge, Energy Opportunity and the Battle for America's Future. Thank you for talking to us again, Michael.
Thank you.
And this is The Source on KSTX. When we come back, we're talking about open carry in Texas. Stay with us.